Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight, after a brief interruption by Tim, we are continuing in the book of Ruth. I appreciate that Tim was able to fill in for me last week. Very strange to go to the website at GCA this week. This is a phenomenon that I have not seen in a couple of years, where the front homepage of our website had no messages from me on it. But I have to tell you that I'm very, very proud of the men of GCA and very grateful that they're not only capable but willing to jump in. And both Tim and Alex not only stood up here and taught and did a good job, but they were both very open and desirous of feedback afterwards because they want to get continually better at it. And so I appreciate not only their willingness and their capability, but I really appreciate their attitude. I get scared of people who want the pulpit in pretty much every church I've ever been a part of. There was the pastor, and then there were always a few men waiting in the wings, hoping the pastor would get sick or travel or something because they wanted the pulpit. And so there was sort of that political tension that you could feel emanating from the men in the church. And I'm just very glad and grateful and blessed that GCA doesn't have any of that. In fact, Tom and Tim and Alex, when they fill in, Jeff, when he's filled in the past, I usually have to talk them into doing it, so at least I don't feel like they're waiting in the wings to knock me off. You know, if I ever, are you feeling a little sick? Well, we can come over and... Tim was motioning. Shh, don't tell him. So I'm very grateful for that. I've gotten a lot of emails and Facebook questions and stuff. Where were you? What happened? So if you don't mind, give me 2 minutes and I'll explain what happened. A week ago Monday, I had the oral surgery that was planned, which was the second stage of the oral surgery that began 6 months ago. So this was the procedure where I had the post put into the cadaver bone that was put into my jaw 6 months ago. So now they put the post in, and when I got home, I was still kind of druggy from the anesthesia, but I had a really terrible sore throat and sinus pain and a really awful headache, all of which I just assumed were the result of the surgery. I thought, well, yeah, the anesthesia is why I have a headache, and gosh, with drilling up into the upper part of my jaw, it's no wonder my sinuses hurt, and my mouth was open for an hour and a half with forced air down my eustachian tubes through my nose, oxygen, no wonder I have a sore throat. So I just assumed that I'd get up the next day and I'd be okay, and I had that left-sided chipmunk cheek thing happening, and I took my antibiotics and pain pill and went to bed and said, there, that's that, I'll be fine tomorrow. And I got up Tuesday and I was sick as a dog. And it turns out that all of those sore throat, sinus problems was the beginning of an upper respiratory virus that I simply got coincidentally to the surgery. The two were not connected in any way, but it sure was a 1-2 punch. And so I was feeling mighty bad by Wednesday and Thursday, and then Friday I started turning the corner, and just really, really glad that I could confidently take the time to lay down, get well, and do what I had to do, knowing that GCA was in good hands. So, Tim, thank you, since you're sitting right there. And Alex, wherever you are, thank you. And Tom, as always, thank you, because Tom always is right there making sure the recordings get done and that the music happens and that we carry on as per normal. I was aware several years ago of a church that was actually an offshoot of a church I was involved in Franklin. The assistant pastor over there left and started a separate church. In the earliest days of that church meeting and for the first couple of years of his pastorate, if he couldn't be there, if he was sick, or even when he and his family would take a vacation, they would close the church. They would shut the doors. They would have no meeting that week. because the pastor couldn't be there. And it was from the very earliest days of GCA, it was always my intention that that never happened to us, because this is about God, this is about His glory, this is about His worship, and this is about His people getting together to fellowship and to worship and enjoy the God who saved them. And the notion that that cannot be done if any single individual person is not present is an idea that I reject wholeheartedly. And so I am glad that we have grown and matured as a church body to the point where if I'm gone, that changes nothing. And the doors are open and the saints arrive and the Bible is taught and songs are sung and prayers go up and God is worshiped and praised. And that is just the way it ought to be, because there's no man, no one man, who is so central to the worship of God that the saints can't carry on without him. I think this past week was good evidence that GCA has grown and matured in a very fine fashion. So I'm very grateful for all that. Okay, so we're in the book of Ruth. Tonight we're going to talk about providence. It actually comes from a Latin word, providio, has just moved its way into our language as providence. Now, of course, there's two words here. Video is the Latin word for seeing, which is why we have YouTube videos. Go to YouTube, you're going to watch something. You're going to see it. That's the root word. Video is to see. Pro means before. And so providence means seeing before. And providence is one of my favorite words. When people talk to me or tell me their story, which I love it when people share their stories and tell me how it is that they came to understand God or His grace or the Bible, how it is that God saved them, how it is that God pulled them out of the world or out of their debauchery or out of their lives or took them from their traditions or their denominational traditions or, you know, brought them to a knowledge of the truth. When they tell me these stories that sometimes go on for pages and pages of how God worked through all these different circumstances and situations in order to bring them to the exact time and place where their eyes were opened and they understood these things, I always write back two words. It's my standard reply. I write back and say, providence works. Because it does. And providence is something that we really only see when we look back on it. Paul says something very interesting. He said, we walk by faith, not by sight. In other words, we walk forward through our lives confident that providence does work, and that as we're walking through our lives, God is guiding our footsteps and our path, opening and closing appropriate doors in order to get us to the places He wants us in order to accomplish His greater will. But we don't see that providence. We don't get to look forward. We don't have the ability to pro-video. We don't look out onto the future and then walk into our future in accordance with what we know about the future. You understand what I mean? There are no crystal balls. Gene Dixon was wrong a lot. I dated myself there, didn't I? There are a lot of people who don't know who that is. Crystal balls don't work. Horoscopes are of no value. We don't know what the future is outside of what the Bible has told us about God's big plans for the future, but I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I got up Monday morning knowing I was going to have some surgery that day. I knew that because we had scheduled it and planned it, but I didn't know that by that night I'd be really sick. Didn't know that. So we have no foreknowledge of our own future events. Rather, we trust that our future events are in the providential hand of God, who is working things out for His great glory and for our best good. So we walk by faith, knowing full well that God's got it handled, but we don't walk by sight. We don't look at the things we see, and we don't have the foresight to know what's coming, and so we don't make our plans on that basis. And I think that's wise, by the way, that God has not told us what's right around the corner, because if we knew what was around the corner, number one, it would scare us. Number two, we would try to change it. We would attempt to alter it. Because we can all think of events in our lives that went so badly that if we could have avoided it, we would have. Instead, God made sure that we went through it and that He, with His great and gracious providential hand, carried us through it so that we could look back in retrospect and say, oh, He never left me. He was with me all the way. And that builds up the kind of hope and the kind of confidence that we then know that whatever we're facing in the future, we're going to get through too, because we got through the last ones, and the stuff we thought was going to kill us didn't, and the stuff that we thought we'd never get through, we got through. And we can recognize that it was only because God took us through it that we got through it. So we don't walk by providence. We don't look forward and know what God's providence is. We walk by faith in God's providence, knowing that He's got tomorrow in His hands. And that nothing, I like this phrase, nothing reaches us that doesn't first pass through nail-scarred hands. Everything that reaches us is exactly what God determined was going to reach us. In other words, two words, providence works. And that's really the essence of chapter 2 of the book of Ruth, because there are several things that are going to happen in these next couple chapters that providentially are exactly what God meant to have happen. And yet, on the surface, looking at it, or even living through it, we're going to try to walk a little bit in Ruth's shoes tonight. If you were Ruth, going through what Ruth was going through, as Tim mentioned last week, 10 years of suffering and struggling and not recognizing that she's completely in the will of God the whole time. Now, let me show you how in the will of God she was and see if I can attach some big picture concept to what we're about to read. Micah 5:2, somebody look that up. This is a very, very interesting prophecy. One of those places where God says something really specific that you can check Him on. This is one of those places where God puts something out there prophetically that you can check Him about. If He misses on this one, then He's not God and prophecy doesn't work. But if He gets it right, then that means that the future is definite, and it's definite because God, in His providence, also has all power so that He can orchestrate the events of human life in such a way that they come out exactly the way He intends for them to come out. Somebody got Micah 5:2? I think you've all got it. I saw you all flipping. You want to read it, Carol?
But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall be come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose going forth have been from of old, from everlasting.
So here's an interesting phrase. God says there's a ruler coming on the planet. He's coming from me, and His coming has been foretold from old, from everlasting. In other words, before the foundation of the world, back when the book of life was being written, the Lamb's book of life, God writing names of the people He's going to save, before the foundation of the world, back when God in Christ agreed about what was going to happen in human history, it was agreed that Christ was going to come to the planet and that He was ultimately going to be the ruler on the planet. And He was going to come to a particular city in Judah. He was going to come to Bethlehem. That's where He was going to arrive. Now, we can check Him on that. So now God's got to make sure that when Jesus is born, He's born in Bethlehem. Of course, you might recall that in the Gospels, when the kings of the East come and talk to Herod, they say, "Where is the king of Israel that we can worship Him?" And so He asks the scribes, "Where is it that the Messiah is supposed to be born?" And they say, "Bethlehem Ephratah." Why? Because Micah said it. And so He's able to tell them, well, the baby was born in Bethlehem. And part of that is the reason then that He wants all the babies in that area to be killed. And He knows what area, because Micah has told Him what area. Okay, now, how is it that God arranges to get Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem to fulfill Micah 5:2. It goes all the way back to Rahab the harlot. Isn't that interesting? So Rahab, who you may recall in the book of Joshua, hid some spies from Israel, and then after having hidden the spies and lying to the, I was looking for the proper word for people from Jericho. I was trying to find a good word for them. Would they be Jerichoans? Okay, never mind. So she lies to the Jericho people who want to find the Israelite spies. They tell her to get her family together there in that little apartment on the wall of the city and to drop a scarlet cord out her window. And then, of course, Jericho falls, and the only thing left standing is the house of this prostitute, this little apartment she was in, and that part of the wall doesn't fall, and it has this scarlet thread hanging out of it, which is just wonderful emblemology or symbology of the blood of Christ hanging out of that window. Okay, so she then apparently got married, and she married somebody, because she's right there in that area of Jericho where the Israelites have now come and occupied. Somebody took her to wife. You're going to see that in just a moment. I'm going to prove it to you. She and her Israelite husband have a child. You know who that child is? A guy named Boaz. Now, Boaz has a whole bunch of land. And on that land, he's got fields. And in those fields, he's got people out there farming, which we're going to read about tonight. And it's on that land that he's farming and that he's taking care of that Ruth is going to come and start gleaning in the fields and discover that he is a near kinsman. He just happens, though he is the child of the prostitute and her Israelite husband, happens to be in the very family and in the very lineage of Abimelech, who is the father-in-law of Ruth, the husband of Naomi. So he then is the near kinsman, and as you know, at the end of the story, he marries Ruth. Now, the two of them have children, and they become the great-grandparents of King David. Now, the lineage, of course, of King David, going through Boaz, has to retain that land, those fields, in perpetuity. Somebody turn to Leviticus 25:25 for a moment. Because there is a rule in Israel, there is a law in Israel, that once God parceled out the land to each individual tribe and each individual family, that land stayed in that family forever. Now, if they sold the land or if they used the land in a debt or in any kind of agreement to pay off a debt, they were able to buy the land back, and the person who had bought it from them in the satisfaction of the debt had to sell it back to them if they had the adequate price. If they couldn't buy it back, their nearest kin could buy it back. And if neither of them could buy it back, every 50 years, in the year of Jubilee, it still went back to them. So no matter what, the fields belonging to Boaz had to stay in the line and the lineage and the family of Boaz. Got that? There's a family lineage leading from Boaz to King David to Jesus, and this is a really important connection. Now, do you remember at the beginning of the book of Ruth where the fields of Boaz were located within Israel?
A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah.
The fields of Boaz are in Bethlehem. Isn't that lucky? God got really lucky here. The fields are in Bethlehem. They belong to the lineage of Boaz in perpetuity. Somebody read Leviticus 25 and read 25 through like 28. You got that, Tom?
Yeah. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the years since he has sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he has sold it. He can then go back to his own property. But if he does not acquire the means to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of the Jubilee. It will be returned in the Jubilee, and he can then go back to his property.
So you understand the deal? The land remains with the family forever. And if they lose it, they can buy it back. If they can't individually buy it back, a near kinsman can buy it back. And if nobody buys it back, every 50 years it goes back to them anyway. So now, you've got these fields that belong to Boaz, that belong to the family lineage, belong to the family line. It's going to work its way down to Jesse, who is the father of David. He's going to end up with this land parcel. And then when we first meet David, when we get into 1 Samuel, what is David doing? He's tending sheep where?
I guess Bethlehem.
In his father's fields, right? Which would be in Bethlehem, same land, same. This is the same family group, same land. So now we know from the beginning of the book of Matthew, turn to Matthew for a moment, Matthew chapter 1. Turn to Matthew. We know that there's a direct descendancy in the genealogy that takes us from King David to Jesus, which means that this land we're talking about, the fields of Boaz, where Ruth is going to be gleaning, is the land that continues in perpetuity to be the property of this family and this lineage, this line. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That connection to David is very important. To Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac, Jacob, and to Jacob, Judah and his brothers. Notice that he mentions Judah and the brothers because he's really interested in the line of Judah because he's pointing toward Jesus. And to Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron, Ram. And to Ram was born Aminadab. And to Aminadab, Nashon. And to Nashon, Salmon. And to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab. See that? So this fellow Salmon married the prostitute Rahab, and through them they had a child who was Boaz. To Boaz was born Obed by Ruth. So Boaz married Ruth, and they have Obed. To Obed, Jesse, and to Jesse was born David the king. And from David was born Solomon to her. And then, of course, you know that from there he follows from all the generations from Abraham to David, and then he goes forward to the Babylonian captivity, and then finally to Jesus. Now, I said all that to say this. Because Micah 5:2 has to come true, Jesus has to be born in Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are a small little city. Nevertheless, out of you is going to come the one who's been foretold since ages past. Was Mary and Joseph, because Mary had now married Joseph's family, were they Bethlehemites? No, where were they living? They were living in Nazareth, which is one of the things that in Jesus' life, one of the things that his detractors threw at him was that he was a Nazarene. And they said in the scriptures, say nothing of a prophet coming out of Nazareth, because they thought the fact that he grew up in Nazareth meant that he didn't fulfill Micah 5:2. So how did God make sure he was born there? He uses a Roman tax and says that everybody has to go back to the place of their family in order to be taxed. That's why Joseph and Mary end up going back to Bethlehem, because that's the place of their family line and lineage. That's where their land is. That's hometown. That's Bethlehem. The reason Bethlehem is their hometown connection goes back to Boaz and goes back even to Rahab, who marries a guy, just haphazardly marries a guy who is a Judahite who lives in Bethlehem, who just happens to be the father of Boaz, who just happens to be near kin to Ruth, who just happens to marry him, and they have King David leading to Christ. So you can hear Linus on the Peanut special explain to you every year they went to Bethlehem for this taxing and accounting, or this Roman idea that everybody had to have a head count and needed to be taxed. And you can just hear that and have no idea that that is the end result of literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of sovereign providence at work. Because God, in his grand sovereign providence, made sure that every event played out with amazing detail and exactitude to bring about the end result he determined before the foundation of the world, and then told human beings about over the course of time, and then later in time made sure that those exact events played out the way he said they were going to play out. And throughout the Old Testament, he's weaving this providential thread, showing you how it is that the end result came about. It didn't happen when Jesus was born. It began all the way back here at Ruth. It began at the fall of Jericho. It began with Rahab lying to some Jerichoites. You understand me? Sovereign providence works that way. And we have to understand it, that when people say, God is in big things. God is in tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, tsunamis, wars. You know, that's where you want God. You want God in the big stuff. That's what he's in control of. But the truth of the matter is, if you really read the Bible and pay attention, he's in charge of the details, the minutiae, the little tiny stuff. It's not just the lot is cast into the lap and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. It's Naomi telling Ruth, go glean in a field. And she just happens to end up in the field of Boaz, who just happens to be her near kin, who just happens to be the one who is going to produce King David and ultimately Jesus. It's those kind of details that you see the hand of God's providence in, but you can miss it if you just read it as a narrative. If you just read it as a story and think, well, that's a nice story, then you miss the backstory, which is God's hand moving in secret behind all of it to bring about exactly what he has determined. And I contend that this is the way God works through all of human history in all circumstances. Why do you believe what you believe? How did you come to the point where you were enlightened? Where were you when you were regenerated? Who did you hear the truth from and through? And what circumstances did you go through in order for you to be open to hearing the truth? And how is it that you were even born in a time, in a place, in a nation, in a country where you had access to the gospel to begin with? And why weren't you born in sub-Saharan Africa somewhere where you didn't have any access to the truth? Or why is it that over the course of time your path crossed with other people who knew really important things and told you these things, and at the time you didn't really hear it or really didn't pay attention to it, but they were planting those seeds that God knew he was going to water and bring to fruition later in your life? And we can look back over the course of our life. I can look over the 56 years of my sojourn here on the planet now and see time and time and time again where God's providential hand just reached in and steered me, turned me, moved me, adjusted me, and then brought people into my life, this person, that person, that person, that person. And they came and they were in my life for a little while, and some of them went away, and some are still here, and some of them, all of them collectively brought me to the place where I am at exactly this moment. And that's what I mean when I say providence. It's God in the details. It's God in the minutiae, doing the things that only God can do, proving his absolute sovereign control of every little element, every little moment, every little decision, every little thing that produces the end result, which is your salvation. That was all introduction. But I didn't get to talk for a whole week, and so I had to make up for it in the introduction. Fortunately, Ruth chapter 2 is essentially a story, so we should be able to read it through and see the providential hand at work. Okay? Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now we know where Boaz came from. We know that he is the child of Rahab and Salmon. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor. And she said, go, my daughter. Now, The comment in chapter 2, verse 1 is sort of it's a literary device. The person writing the book of Ruth, who, like I told you 2 weeks ago, I suspect is probably Samuel, he's telling us that this Boaz guy exists. But you'll notice that Naomi does not say, you have a near kinsman. Well, I have a near kinsman named Boaz. He's got some land. Go there. Instead, she just says, we got nothing. We're hungry. Let me go out and glean in the fields. Now, you may recall that there was a rule back in the Levitical rules that said that when you gleaned a field, or that when you harvested a field, when you went out and plowed a field to take in the harvest, you may recall that right at the end of chapter 1, the very last thing we read is that they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So now they're beginning the wheat and the barley, and they're going to be threshing it out. And as the threshing is happening, the law says that you have to leave the corners, and anything that falls to the ground in the course of threshing, you leave there. And that it's there to be gleaned by the poor and the fatherless and the widows. And so this was God's way of providing for the poor. If you had plenty and you had land and you had a good harvest, which God had given you, then you had to leave some of it behind. And so it was known among the poor that they could go into the fields and they could glean, which means just find the stuff that fell on the ground. Now, this is tough work. This is backbreaking work. This is going out into the sun, into the fields, and just finding whatever seed or stalks have hit the ground, and then picking it up and having to do the cleaning and everything for yourself. It's tough work. However, it's especially tough if you're a woman. And you're going to see that come out in the story, because now you're a single woman out in the fields. And you may recall in the law, there were a lot of rules about women being safe, women not being accosted in the fields. If you did accost a woman in a field, you had to take her to wife, or you had to pay a fee and stuff. Because if you were just a single woman in a field where no one could hear you or see you or find you, you were a victim. You were a target. And so she's taking a huge risk here, and she's going out to do the backbreaking work, all of that to tell you how hungry they were. Because as I've told you, in biblical times, the chief task every day was find food. So she's going to go out and find food for her and her mother-in-law. Verse 3. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Anybody got a King James on them? What does the King James say in verse 3? Because there's this wonderful word they chose that I actually like.
And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and her hap was to lie on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech.
I love the word hap. It's the word from which we get happening, happenstance, haphazard. It's a word that means, in our English language, it means chance. It just happened. It's just the way things turned out. And so Samuel writes that she went into the field and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, in our lives, that's the way we think stuff happens. Yeah, it just happened that way. Why did it go that way? Well, that's just the way it happened. Why did it turn out that way? It just happened that way. What we're going to find out is that was providence. That was God quietly, secretly, behind the scenes, making sure that she just, quote unquote, happened to be in the field of the one person who God had determined she was going to marry in order to bring about David and Jesus, to make sure that Jesus was born in Bethlehem.
The seed of David.
Through the seed of David, in that land area. So there's all this providence going on, and it just happened. You get the point? I'm really trying to drive home this point that as we walk through our lives, we keep thinking that stuff just happens. But the happenstance of our lives is the providence of God at work. Whatever happens, that's what God meant to have happen, or else providence doesn't work. But as I keep saying, two words, providence works. We're going to have to move here. I just like this so much. I just enjoy this so much. And I haven't talked for a week. So she departed, and she went, and she gleaned in the field of the reapers, and she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech, as we found out back in verse 1. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. In other words, that particular day that she's gleaning in the field, he just happened to come in from Bethlehem and go check his fields. Wasn't that lucky? Yeah. So he came in from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." That's a nice greeting. I want to go back to that greeting. I want to replace "Hi, how you doing?" with "May the Lord be with you."
It's better than sup.
Sup. Exactly. We're going to replace sup. We're going to replace that with "the Lord be with you." Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" In other words, she's a maid of somebody. She belongs to somebody. Who does she belong to? What's she doing out here in the field? And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." Now, apparently, people knew this story, because in a few moments, it's going to become clear that Boaz knows the whole backstory and is going to compliment her on the backstory. So apparently, once they got there to Bethlehem, news spread, of course. Remember in chapter 1, we read that Naomi's friends came to her and said, "It's Naomi, she's back." And she said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Bitter, call me Mara." And so clearly, she's told the story. And that story has spread because Boaz knows the tale. And now he realizes that this is Ruth, the Moabite girl.
That says all the town, the city was exciting because of them. They had heard they were coming.
Exactly. That's what chapter 1 told us. The whole city was excited about them coming back. So verse 7. And she had said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." In other words, after they're done with the reaping, let me come along behind them and pick up whatever's hitting the ground. Thus she came and has remained from morning until now, and she's been sitting in the house for a while. The word house there, what does the King James have?
Tarried a little in the house.
Out in the sun, working all day. There would be these kind of ramshackle coverings that they could get into the shade and get out from under the hot beating sun. And apparently she had asked whether or not she could come along behind the reapers, but then she had remained in that house there, apparently not knowing if she was safe. He's going to reassure her in a moment that she is safe. And she's been sitting there in the house for a little while. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in any other field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids." In other words, be part of the group, and my reapers look after my maids. You'll be under my hand of protection. You're going to be safe. "Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you." In other words, you're going to be safe. You're going to be all right. You're not going to be attacked in my field. "And when you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered and said to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." It's not nice language. That's the language of the way a mother bird would lay out her wings over her babies to make sure they were safe and keep them protected. And this is language that Isaiah uses too, that idea of being under the protective wings of God. So she said, "I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not insult her." In other words, she doesn't just have to pick up what fell behind. Let her go into the stalks, into the stuff that's yet to be cut down, and let her go in there and glean so she doesn't have to bend down and pick it up off the ground. Let her go right up to the stalk and glean some of the fruit right off it. This is really nice of him. It's very, very kind of the man. And also, he tells them, you shall purposefully pull out some of her grain from the bundles and leave it so that she can glean it, and don't rebuke her. Don't insult her, don't rebuke her, don't touch her, make sure you protect her, and make sure you let some of the grain fall right in front of her on purpose. Now, the King James, again, has this wonderful phrase, because I first fell in love with the Book of Ruth in the King James, so a lot of the King James language rattles through my head. But there's this wonderful phrase, handfuls of purpose, right? Read it for us, Carol.
And let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, and leave them that she may glean them and rebuke her not.
Now, of course, what the phrase means is let some of the handfuls of grain fall on purpose. But there's this great phrase in there, handfuls of purpose. And I have heard songs and sermons and handfuls of purpose. But what it really means is let handfuls fall on purpose right in front of her. Make her work easy. Let her go glean among the stalks and take some of that grain that you've gleaned, take a couple handfuls, and just let it fall right in front of her on purpose. Don't make her work for it. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, because, of course, you've got the kernel and you've got the meat inside the kernel. It still has to be beaten in order to separate the wheat from the chaff. So there's all this work involved. You're out there in the hot sun, you're doing the gleaning, you're doing a lot of bending down, you're picking up whatever seeds or fruit you can find on the ground, you're gathering it, usually in their dress or in some kind of bundle they would be holding. So just really hard work. And then after that, you still don't get to eat. You still have to beat the wheat. You still have to separate the wheat from the chaff and then cook it. So that's why it's so important that he gave her some of the finished bread to eat. And she was filled right there, so that she got to eat before she even had to do the work. And she took it up, and she went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. Her mother-in-law then said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." What a wonderful phrase. That's the moment at which Naomi realizes that despite everything they've been through and all the loss that they've endured, that God had not abandoned them. It's very common. I don't have a lot of time to talk about this or develop this, but it's very common for us when we're going through the worst circumstances of our life. It's very common when things get tougher, when we go through a long, dry period. It's real easy for us to start thinking, where is God in all this? Especially if we forget about the concept of God's sovereign providence. It's real easy to start thinking, don't you like me anymore? I thought things were going good. I'm working hard down here, and now you apparently have abandoned me completely. And that apparently is the way Naomi was thinking, especially as she was walking around saying, "Call me bitter. God has dealt bitterly with me," she said. But now, as she sees not only a nice harvest of food brought in at the hands of Ruth, she also recognizes that sovereign providence has occurred. And she says this, "May he who took notice of you be blessed." She said, "His name is Boaz." Naomi said, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Now, the reason she would say that God has not withdrawn his kindness from the dead is that she's saying, up until this moment, I thought we were going to lose the land. My sons are dead. My husband is dead. We have no posterity. But now, if you know Boaz, there's a ray of hope that there's going to be redemption, and we're not going to lose everything because the man is our near relative, and he is one of our closest relatives. Now, that whole phrase, one of our closest relatives, or he is our near kinsman, is a single Hebrew word that I introduced you to 2 weeks ago, ga'al. In the English, it's migrated into the word goel. And it means redeemer. It means the near kinsman who has the ability to redeem. Now, I don't expect you to remember it from 2 weeks ago, so I won't turn it into a quiz. Lucky you. But in order for someone to be a kinsman redeemer, there were specific requirements. First, they had to be the nearest of kin. And as we're going to find out next week, there is somebody nearer to Ruth and Naomi than Boaz. There is a nearer kinsman. And so whoever the nearest kinsman is has sort of first right of refusal. And there are rules concerning it, and we're going to look at those rules out of Deuteronomy next week. Perhaps the week after, but something in there. You have to be the nearest kinsman. You have to have the price. Remember what we read out of Leviticus? You could buy it back as long as you had the money to buy it back. And it had to be the correct price, the fair price, whatever the debt was. You had to be able to pay it back. You have to be the nearest kin, and you have to have the price, and you have to be willing. And what we're going to find out is that the nearest kinsman isn't willing. And we'll read out of Deuteronomy, like I said, what happens when someone is not willing to do the work of the goel, because the work of the goel is a responsibility. It's a requirement. If you are the near kinsman, if you are the nearest kin, you have to raise up seed. If there's a circumstance exactly like this, the husband is dead, there is no posterity, then the nearest kinsman must raise up seed in order for that land to remain in that family in perpetuity, like God said. So if there's any possible way, he has to follow through. If not, he's publicly shamed. And the man takes the public shame rather than go through with the redemption process. Because if you raise up the seed, then the land and the heritage goes to the seed. It would not be the near kinsman's land. And so it changes the right of inheritance. So the goel has to be the nearest kin, has to have the price, and has to be willing to pay it. Those are the rules of the goel. All of which are preparing us for Jesus, the Redeemer, to come onto the planet. One of the reasons that he took up flesh and blood was so that he would be our nearest kin, which is why we read the language of brothers. And that he is our elder brother, and that he is not ashamed to call us brethren. He took on flesh and blood so that he would be our nearest kin. Then the next requirement is he has to actually have the price. And the price God required was his blood, his death. So he had the price. But then he had to be willing. And that's what makes the Garden of Gethsemane moment so important. Because he does say, I mean, he's afraid, he's terrorized, he's praying, sweating like blood, and saying, you know, if there was any way that this cup could pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. At that moment, it says that as soon as he said that, the soldiers arrive in the garden and they take him and the whole thing begins. As soon as he turns himself over to God and gives himself up willingly. You know, Jesus walked around saying things like, no man takes my life from me, but I lay it down willingly. And I have the right to lay it down, and I have the power to take it up again. And this is the command that I have from my Father. So Jesus takes the time to speak very plainly about the fact that his life is the ransom. He's going to give his life for a ransom. His life, his blood becomes the ransom payment. and that he makes that payment most willingly, which makes him our Goel, our Redeemer, and he does it because he's our nearest kin. Isn't that great? All of that is prefigured and foreshadowed back here. God weaving that providential thread again through the Old Testament so that when Jesus walks on the planet, it's not just that he fulfills showing up in Bethlehem. It's not just that he fulfills being of the lineage of David. It's not just that he fulfills prophecies from Isaiah that he's going to die and yet going to raise again. It's that he is fulfilling the whole of the structure of the law and the requirements and the sacrifices and the blood and the sin offerings, and that he is also fulfilling things like this, our near kinsman, our Goel, our Redeemer, the one who sets us apart, the one who sanctifies. There's just so much stuff in the Old Testament that prefigures and foreshadows Christ, and it's so intrinsic to the Old Testament that if you're reading the Old Testament and all you're getting out of it is nice stories of history and nations moving around, you're missing the key story, because Jesus did say, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you have life, but they are they which testify of me. When he was walking on the Emmaus Road with the two disciples, and they were saying, you know, they were downcast, and he said, you know, what are you talking about? And they said, don't you know what's happened around here? It says, starting at the law and the prophets, he showed them everything pertaining to him. And so he was able to just go through the law and the prophets, which is Moses and the prophetic books, and say, this is me, and this is me, and this is me, and this is also me, here's me again, this would also be me. This is all about the Christ, so that he could prove to them that everything that happened while they were walking around going, we thought he was going to be the Messiah of Israel, and now he's dead. And he says, isn't that what the prophet said? That of course Messiah was going to have to die. That's exactly what it says. Look at the text, look at the scripture, look at the Old Testament. So if you're reading the Old Testament and you're missing Christ in it, then you're still not reading the Old Testament, because the whole of the Old Testament is leading you inexorably, with no exit ramps, straight toward Christ. It's what it's all geared toward. Now they didn't know it while they were living it. They didn't see it while they were enduring it. But God's providential hand was moving nations and people and situations and famines and floods, earthquakes, or all the events of life. He was weaving all that together in a beautiful tapestry that would end up a great big picture of Jesus. And he knew what he was doing the whole time. They didn't know. Same way we don't know. But we walk by faith believing that he does know. And someday we'll look down from our heavenly estate, you know, watch the course of earth playing out and say, yep, just like you said. Yes, ma'am.
All right. The men on Emmaus said, on the road to Emmaus said, we hoped it was he who was going to redeem Israel.
Yeah, when he says he would have delivered Israel, I don't think that was just deliverance of the land. He was going to deliver Israel, the scattered tribes. He was going to do everything the prophets had said.
He was going to redeem Israel.
Absolutely.
He was going to get the claim to the land.
Right. But not just the land. I think it's the people of the land. It's the nation of Israel.
Right.
And by the way, that's such an interesting thing you bring up, and I know I got to wrap it up here. But you'll notice what their expectation was. After 3.5 years of walking and talking with him, what was their understanding of who he was and what he came to accomplish?
That he would reestablish David's kingdom.
And that he would be the Redeemer, Goel, of Israel. And unfortunately, so much of the church world, I just had to again address this yet again today on Facebook. So many people say, but then the church came, and so he's the Redeemer of the church. And he is the Redeemer of all the elect saints. And they utterly negate, try to just do away with and brush it under the carpet, the fact that his ministry, his goal, his identifiable characteristic was he's the Redeemer of Israel. So we can't ever extricate that from the big picture. The big picture is always Jesus is the Goel of Israel, because if we think he's our near kin, he came to his own, and his own received him not. He was born a Judahite. He was born a Jew, an Israelite. They are nearer kin than we are. And he is their Goel as much as he is our Goel. And they have every bit as much reason to hope in him as we do. And you can't eliminate that from the Bible without doing phenomenal damage to the text. All right, let's close up this chapter. Gotta go. Where'd you glean today? His name is Boaz. Boaz is our Goel, our nearest relative. Verse 21, then Ruth the Moabitess said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until you have finished all my harvest, until they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, lest others fall upon you in another field. There again is that sense of danger. There was a real sense of danger. Single woman in the field somewhere, you're going to be attacked, you're going to be fallen on. So she says, you do that. Stay with his maids because you're going to be safe there. That's a good plan. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. We'll start in chapter 3 next week, and we will see the providential hand of God continue to work in their lives in order to accomplish a goal that's hundreds of years away from them, that they don't know anything about, that they don't even see coming, but he's going to do it anyway because he's in charge. And providence works.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.